This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. Maybe your next-door neighbor, maybe someone down the street, but until you take the time to ask, you'll never know the kinds of things that have been done for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's going to be the case today in Las Vegas, Nevada, with 90-year-old Jim Roach, a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force, dating back to when it was still the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. And I know you've been in Las Vegas for quite a while now, but I want to take you back to the early days, growing up in Ogden, Utah. What was life like in Ogden, Utah in the 1930s as a young boy?
It was the height of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And life was pretty austere, pretty frugal. Nobody had much money to speak of, and everybody was pretty much in the same boat. There wasn't a whole lot of money around. It was pretty grim, pretty tough on everybody.
Did that mean you had to start working at a pretty young age to support the family?
Well, no. I picked odd jobs in the summertime, picking fruit and things of that nature. But when I was about 14 or 15 years old age, I got a paper route. And that was a lucrative job for a teenager. In addition to carrying the paper route, I did some work in the mailroom, which I was paid for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you deliver your papers on a bicycle or on
foot?
Oh,
yes. Oh, on a bicycle.
All the best people in the world have delivered papers on a bicycle. That's what I did when I was that age, too. Lots of fun. Good memories. And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have three sisters.
And so Ogden, Utah, you grow up there. Beautiful city, by the way. The scenery around there, the landscape is spectacular. Must have been a fun childhood. But there's one day that everybody seems to remember. Every veteran I've interviewed, if I ask them about a specific date, they always have something to say. I guess you would have been about 17 years old on December 7th, 1941.
I was.
You remember that day?
I certainly do. I was home with the flu.
Uh-oh.
And I told him, I said, I just can't do it. I'm ill. I'm not well. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do it.
And Utah is a long way from Hawaii. But did news of Japan attacking United States territory, was that a shock to the system? Was that a big deal to you?
Well, I was greatly surprised, but other than that, I mean, I was pretty young. I wasn't too much concerned about it at that time. But then I graduated high school in May of 1942, and I announced at the time that I was to my friends and my family that upon reaching my 18th birthday in October, that I was going to join the Aviation Cadet Program and become a pilot. And everybody thought that was a pretty far-fetched idea.
Had you ever flown before?
No. But I just was enamored with aircraft, and so I thought I would give it a shot. My first obstacle to overcome was getting my parents' approval. I was the only son. They weren't anxious to see me go running off to war, but after haggling with them for a couple of months, I finally got their permission, and so I went off into the pilot training program and graduated when I was 19 years of age.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it, and you think about 19-year-olds you know today and what they're up to. I've got to ask you, you mentioned that you were enamored with aviation. What was it? Was it reading about Lindbergh? Was it seeing planes going over?
We went out to the airport one day, and I saw these airplanes, and I watched a few of them take off, small aircraft. There was no airliner in Ogden then, in those days.
I've got to ask you, you mentioned that you were enamored with aviation. What was it? Was it reading about Lindbergh? Was it seeing planes going over?
We went out to the airport one day, and I saw these airplanes, and I watched a few of them take off, small aircraft. There was no airliner in Ogden then, in those days. I just thought, wow, that must be an awful lot of fun. I better give that a shot.
Mm-hmm. And you did.
I did.
And I've heard a lot of stories from guys who wanted to do what you did, and they went into the Army Air Corps to try to become pilots, but they couldn't make it. They ended up as navigators or bombardiers or gunners because it wasn't easy to get through all that pilot training.
True. It was. When you stop and think about it, it was, like I've told Pat, I said, you know, there are thousands of pilots, but when you take it in context of the population in general, hundreds of millions of people, we're really just a small group.
Well, it's a really small group when you consider what you've done. And Pat, of course, is your wife of 66 years now. I'm going to get the story of how you met before we're done. But if you want a small sample size, guys who flew in World War II and Vietnam, which you did, and in between some pretty fascinating duty in the Cold War that we're going to talk about. But so here you declare as an 18-year-old that you're going to be a pilot. How many hours do you have now in the air?
Just a little over 10,000.
10,000 hours.
But you see, as not that I ever achieved great rank, but as you ascend in rank, you're bogged down with other duties and what have you. Like, I was the squadron operations officer in that spook squadron in Germany, which ties me down some.
I just noticed the belt buckle you're wearing. It's a B-24
on
your belt buckle. And that would be the first plane you flew in combat. But you have in your office here photographs of all the planes that you flew in your 30 years in the military. And the first one there is a Stearman.
Yes.
You can go to an air show today and you can see some guys going up in the Stearman and taking people up to feel that wind in their face in the open cockpit. What was that like for you as a teenager to get a taste of that?
Awesome. You know, when you're that young, you adapt readily. I soloed. I was the second person in my class to solo. I soloed with 6 hours and 20 minutes. The guy that finished first, he already had pilot experience. So I was the second in my class to solo. It was 6 hours and 20 minutes, and most of them were going into 10 and 12 hours.
You were a quick study.
It was just like rolling out of bed for me. I mean, I hate to sound boastful, I guess, but I had no problem with aircraft. I mean, it came naturally to me.
But becoming a pilot in the Army Air Corps at that time was a lot more than just being good in the air. There were a lot of things that you had to study, a lot of things you had to learn, to master, to demonstrate that you were capable of. Was there any part of that training that you wondered if you'd be able to master that was any kind of challenge to you?
No, I was a good student. Mm-hmm. I took all the tough courses in high school. I took all the math courses and physics and science courses. 2 years of German, I had it all, and I graduated when I was 17. Mm-hmm. So I had it all. I mean, I hate to sound boastful, but I mean, it was really very simple, very easy. It really was easy for me.
It sounds like you're saying it's what you were born to do.
Well, I'll tell you what. We had a rental unit over here. The folks that were renting it from us were Germans. He was a German rocket scientist.
Hmm.
And they were getting ready to rotate back to Germany. And I told them that when they moved out, I was going to sell that place because God didn't put me on earth to be a landlord. He put me on the earth to fly airplanes. And I don't want to be a landlord when you guys leave. So that was that.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone's going to argue with you when they hear the rest of your story. And how old were you when you got your wings?
19.
19 years old.
19.
And then they give you a B-24 and a crew.
Well, after I went to B-24 transition, and that was a tough school for going from those light airplanes into a B-24 because that was a modern aircraft.
And a big aircraft, yes, and a heavy aircraft.
Yes, it was. And I'd say at least 10% of the students flunked out. And they were sent off to be pilots and other co-pilots in other aircraft. My co-pilot in B-24s was a washed-out B-17 pilot.
Mm.
When he graduated in pilot training, he went to B-17 school, and he didn't make it.
Mm.
So he was assigned as a co-pilot in B-24s. But as I said, in B-24 transition, at least 10% of the class were washed out and then sent off to do co-pilots in other aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Were you eager to get overseas and actually be part of this?
This is another story. When I was going to B-24 school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's a university town.
Mm-hmm.
And here we were with, pardon me, real young kids with a pocket full of money. All those girls were there. We're having a good time. But there was on the other side of the field was a bombardier school. And from time to time, after those guys acquired a certain amount of flying time and flight experience, then they would be sent off to fly other aircraft. So our instructor came to my flying partner and me one day, and he said, they have a requirement for some pilots over in the bombardier training school. Were either of you interested in going? And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, no, I want to go to the big dance. Mm. And I wanted to go to fly the B-24 in Europe.
Well, and let's think about the implications of that. So you're offered an opportunity to stay in the States and fly around Albuquerque and in that part of the country just to train the bombardiers who are going to go over, and you wouldn't have had to go over.
Not at that time.
Yes, and maybe not at all.
Maybe not at all.
But you said, I want to go get right in the thick of it.
Well, I told him that I was not interested. My flying partner didn't. We both said, no, we want to stay with the B-24 and see what it's like over there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did.
Even though I'm sure you'd seen all the newspapers and heard all the stories of all the planes that have been shot down in Europe.
But that's not going to happen to me.
Uh-huh.
See, it's always the next guy. It's that other guy that gets shot down. You don't ever get shot down.
Mm-hmm. I know this is a long time ago, but when was it that you did head overseas, and what do you remember thinking at the time about what was in front of you?
I don't think we worried too much about it. We were all at Hamilton Field, and we were all scheduled to go to the Pacific. And then while we were waiting there, the order came out and changed the whole affair. We were put on trains, and we went from Hamilton Field to Newport News, Virginia.
Mm.
And on a long boat ride over to Italy, and we got over there, and that was that. It was just, you know, when you're that young, you just take it as it comes. You don't worry too much about anything. I don't think I was worried about anything. I wasn't worried about getting killed. I thought a lot about it when I was over Vienna, of course.
Well, yeah, I've got some photographic evidence you just showed me right here of the flak over Vienna, and we'll put these all at hometownheroesradio.com. Another photo you have here shows your crew. So it's you and nine other gentlemen, 10-man crew on the B-24, and three of you still are alive today. You 10 flew all 15 of your missions together, but my question was, had you had the chance to train with that crew before you headed overseas?
Oh, yes. Upon graduation from B-24 transition, then we were assigned to what they called a replacement training unit,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the crew was formed. It was up here in Tonopah, Nevada, as a matter of fact.
All right.
So then we trained together for about 6 weeks. We flew formation. We did some aerial gunnery, did some practice bombing, and that was it. As I said, we all went to Hamilton Field. Orders were changed. Not going to go to the Pacific, going to go to Europe. So I took the long train ride and then the boat ride over to Italy.
Now, I know there's all kinds of what-ifs, and your story in 30 years in the Air Force, I'm sure we could be here for a week talking about what-ifs. But the war in the Pacific went on a lot longer than the war in Europe. Have you ever thought about how your experience would have been different had you gone to the Pacific?
Well, it wasn't that much longer. It was only about 3 months.
That's a lot of missions you would have flown in three months.
That's true. and we wouldn't have been faced with the weather. Mm-hmm. See, that was the big bugaboo over in Europe, was the weather. It was terrible weather. We'd be on the schedule to fly. And we go, of course, get up and go to the intelligence briefing and get all suited up and get in the airplane and get airborne. And then you might have the whole group, usually 40 airplanes, maximum effort. 4 squadrons, 10 planes for each squadron. And you get airborne and it'd be a recall. So you get nothing out of it. But that happens fairly often.
With that weather.
Terrible weather.
Well, everyone has heard how awful the winter was in Europe in 1944 on into 1945.
Yes.
And you're serving with the 485th Bomb Group, the 830th Squadron, this 10-man B-24 crew. And you mentioned having the 6 weeks to train with that exact crew. What did you come to appreciate about those other men in that time? Did you guys form a pretty quick bond?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were all very, very close. What can I say? I mean, we were all in it together, you know.
Yeah.
And if there's anything that provides camaraderie in a hurry, is being in combat together. That's so true. I read, and not only did I experience that, I read so much about it. And nothing forms camaraderie more quickly and more lastingly than being in combat with people. And I found that to be true in Vietnam as well.
I'm just trying to picture myself in your shoes. You've just celebrated your 20th birthday. And now you're flying bombing missions over highly protected targets, and you're responsible not just for yourself, but a 10-man crew on this B-24. Did you feel that responsibility? Was that a burden that you had to carry?
I did. I felt like I owed it to the guys to do the best I could. I did. I tried my best, of course. In the process of saving my own rear end, you know. So
sure.
But anyway, I tried to use my head. I give an example. On takeoff, there was a hill off to the left of our runway. The procedure was to fly straight ahead till you had 500-foot altitude above that hill. Then you make your left turn, and by the time you crossed over the hill, you'd be about 1,000 feet above the hill. Well, a brand new crew in our squadron, the guy didn't drive straight ahead. He turned left too soon, ran into that mountain. With 2,700 gallons of high-octane aviation fuel.
Oh.
You can imagine what was left of that aircraft after it hit that mountain.
And that's 10 guys gone in an instant.
And it was that was his responsibility, not only for him, to him and his family, but to all the guys on board with him. It was his responsibility.
Yeah.
To take care of those guys the best he could. It was a big shock for all of us because everybody knew that hill was there, and we all flew straight ahead, as I said.
Yeah, and that sounds like a pretty sobering situation. There would be more of those ahead, and we'll explore some of Jim Roach's 15 missions as a B-24 pilot in Europe during World War II when we come back. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're right back after a word about some of my friends who make this program possible.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.